for Penn National's biggest day of the season, the $400,000 Grade 3 Penn Mile and the $150,000 Penn Oaks will both be run Friday, May 31st, on a card that also includes two Pennsylvania Bred Stakes, each with a $100,000 purse. Call the racing office at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse, 800-233-8238. That's 800-233-8238. Nominations close May 15th.
We're racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky. Please consider Bleeder Shield, the leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action in thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts breeding program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Whether you're new to the racing game or just looking to enhance your operation, Hermitage Farm and Goshen can help you. We are conveniently located between Churchill Downs and Keeneland Racecourse and near world-renowned equine hospitals. With spacious paddocks, expert staff, and qualified veterinarians, we offer full-service boarding, breeding, and sales preparation, as well as post-operative care and layup services. Visit us in person or online at hermitagefarm.com.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Scholarships are available. Visit rtip.arizona.edu.
Down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's dancing behind movie scenes, behind the movie scenes. Sadi Rani, she's the one that keeps the dream alive. From the morning past the evening to the end of the life. Grim Poodle Asher on the 45. Well, it's a Grim Poodle Asher on the 45. Grim Poodle Asher on the 45. Well, it's a
we're back. About 15 to top of the hour, and down to Ocala we go. Seth Morris, who you last heard from on Sunday of the NHC when he was vying for the top prize. He settled for second in the NHC, but that experience and, you know, some other intrigue brings him back, and the intrigue comes in the form of a couple of hips that'll sell over the next 4 days at OBS April, and happy to get Seth Morris back on in a different capacity. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Happy to be on.
Well, and this is fun, and I think it's instructive and intriguing, because you know we meet you more as a handicapper when it came to NHC, and you have big success there. And you know, you had mentioned, you know, in our first conversation that, you know, you were doing some bloodstock work over the, you know, the past year plus, and you know, here it comes right into focus. At the OBS, first at March, now today you're going to sell one that is getting a ton of attention, and you know, talk about gambling in a different format when it comes to the pinhooking.
I mean, I'd say the gambling into bloodstock kind of tracks, you know, over a longer period of my life. I mean, I've been, you know, handicapping and gambling since I was in high school. And, you know, in the early 2000s, when I was living out in California, I first, you know, went over to a barn and met Steve Miotti, a trainer, and started working on Saturdays, just, you know, just hanging out and learning a little bit more. And over the last, you know, 20 years, I've gotten progressively more involved, you know, at various levels of the industry, as, you know, owning some, breeding a couple. And I've been going to the sales since 2011. So I would say, like, you know, in terms of, you know, a foundation of bloodstock, it's been there for a while. I still have plenty to learn, but I've been going to the two-year-old sales for years. I had never pinhooked before this year, you know, and I started going into it full time this year. So I've liked the two-year-olds. I met Nick Sallusto years ago in you know, 2011, 2012, I walked around sales with him. So we've had a long relationship, and, you know, decided to do some pinhooking this year, picked up a couple of investors. There are some great, you know, tax advantages coming in. And, you know, I thought that, you know, with my eye and experience and with, you know, the contacts and the bloodstock and the eye that Nick has, you know, that we would be able to do well, kind of like in a first year trial run. You know, which turned out to be a pretty big trial run. You know, we bought 12 horses that averaged $100,000. And, you know, I think, you know, have learned a ton throughout the process from both Nick and Michelle Hemingway and their team, you know, and then just generally about the pinhooking process, you know, and what you're looking for, and, you know, how the horses are broken and prepped, and, you know, the differences among consigners. So it's been an eye-opening experience. But, you know, back to the horses that Nick is selling, you know, Hip 125 was a Nyquist colt that he purchased. You know, we purchased at Timonium in the fall. He was the sale topper there. And he was relatively immature, you know, colt, you know, by a sire that we liked. We loved Nysos in the fall. You know, so he was very attractive. And, you know, I had some questions, and Nick and Michelle said, wait till you see this horse, the improvement that you're going to see in this horse. And, you know, we've really seen it, you know, through the time on the farm. You've just seen him blossom. And even from, you know, 3 weeks ago when I was down for the March sale, you know, he's really flourished. So he worked well. He looks great back at the barn. I think people are looking at him. We'll see how it goes, you know, very excited. And, you know, later in the sale, we have a Cupid colt that is extremely fast, you know, has worked great, you know, consistently at the farm over the dirt. You know, looks like he could handle any surface. And, you know, I'm excited about him. He's a different type, more of probably a fall two-year-old if I, you know, had to pinpoint it, and, you know, probably shorter distance. But I'm excited about both of them. And Nick's consignment looks very good. You know, I've been walking around the sale, and I'm excited for, you know, for Nick on some of his other horses. And I'm excited we have three horses going to Maryland. So the pinhooking's been great. We'll see what happens in about 3 or 4 hours. Yeah, so that's it on pinhooking. I didn't know if you had any specific questions on it.
Well, I would ask the approach, and if there was a variety of approaches. I mean, in terms of the stock that get identified, new sires. I mean, obviously Cupid and Nyquist are established, but you know, you guys picking out individuals. Talk a little bit about about that aspect.
Absolutely. I think it starts with individuals, right? And it starts with, an all-encompassing, you know, team effort to really get through thousands of hips and not miss something, right? You don't want to miss something on the first look because you want to get the rest of the team to look at something. So that's really the key. And from there, narrowing and narrowing and narrowing, and then looking at a myriad of things. You know, you're looking at what the market is going, you know, anticipating what the market might look like in a few months. You're looking at what sires might be hot, what, you know, horses might be out there working or running that, you know, might turn into a stakes winner. You know, what will people be looking for? And then from an individual perspective, you're looking at each individual and saying, you know, every individual is different, right? So, hey, this one has the frame to, you know, go work 10 flat, and it looks like an early horse and has, you know, a nice hip and speed and plenty of bone, looks, you know, passes the physical. You know, it is a new sire, or it's a Florida bred. You know, it's going to have a cap to it, right? So, you know, now we're going to have a sliding cap on what we can pay for that horse, thinking about a best case, or we call it a 3-to-1 ratio on each horse. And if you're looking at each horse from that perspective and then putting together a diversified portfolio to try to meet investor demand at various levels of the two-year-old sales, I think that's the approach and the thought process. And then you have to, you know, then you have to be right. Right. So if you say, hey, this sire looks really good, and, you know, then the sire's, you know, not so good or a little bit dead, you know, you might be wrong. And if you're right, you're going to get a little bit more attention from the people that are really coming and looking at the book and coming and not necessarily purely going on physicals first. And then once they're back at the barn, you know, if the horse works well, they're going to say, wow, look at that horse on the shank. You know, these guys picked the boxes, and, you know, we don't want buyers coming off a horse for a physical reason. So that's where Nick and Michelle and their experience really came in, because I, you know, I look at race horses and I'll try to identify 2-year-olds that might have some flaws, but you can run through them. And it's certainly a different experience buying to Pinhook, because there's certain things that are going to limit the, you know, the prices that you're going to get at a 2-year-old sale. So, yeah, that's really like kind of the thought process on a horse by horse basis, you know, and then, you know, trying to have a bunch of different sires, you know, and then there's, you know, I don't want to speak because, you know, I'm not the consigner, but I'm sure if you have multiple sires, you know, we put them in different sales and stuff. So I think, you know, we did a good job of getting through it. We identified some good horses, you know, so far we've done pretty well, and I'm excited about the group, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, excited for you. And, you know, you hinted at this when we talked in Las Vegas. What portion of your gambling budget remains in the bankroll, and what portion, I mean, what advice do you have for people on both sides of that coin in terms of, you know, because frankly, you know, if you spent, what, $500,000, it sounds like, you know, if it's a 50-50 split. But, you know, talk about establishing a budget and what you suggest people that are, you know, that are intrigued by this avenue. What advice do you have for them?
Well, to be fair, I have investors too on my end, right?
Okay.
And Nick Saluso certainly stayed in on every one of these horses, you know, which, so our interests are aligned. You know, so those investors are also interested in racing. You know, and like I said, these are people that I've talked to and known for a long time, that have known my passion for the game, that have known me in various capacities, you know, that understand some of the negative publicity, call it, or some of the inefficiencies around the sale process. You know, it's not easy to navigate. It's certainly non-transparent. So you need somebody that you can trust. And I think that, you know, it takes a while for someone to, you know, get your blood stock abilities. You know, I think it's easy to be like, oh, just go to someone that you've heard of, or that, you know, has been around horses for 30 years or whatever. And I do think that that's incredibly important, and that's why I've tried to put in the time. And I think, you know, I've had support, you know, over the last 10 years from Stephen Mack. We've purchased, you know, a limited number of horses, but he's, you know, allowed me to go to the sales and truly hone my skills. So I think I mentioned we had Monty Mann, Stan the Man. And then we partnered with Saul Kumin and his group on, you know, so I was able to, you know, get in on horses like Tammy the Torpedo that I didn't pick out, but we had a great experience and got to the Breeders' Cup. And, you know, I met Chad Brown and, you know, just expanding the, you know, the group of people that you know. You know, I had most of the horses were trained with John and Tanya Terranova, who I love. And, you know, right now I've got a couple of different groups that I'm looking for at the 2-year-old sales and, you know, where they're going to, we're going to bring these horses to John and Tanya, which I'm very excited about. Cause I think they're super capable. I'll give a ton of transparency. I'm at the barn anytime I'm in New York, I'm at the barn with these horses. And it's just great to have that level of communication. So for me, it's been like years of trying to develop the team and the relationships and kind of keep it tight. At the same time, you know, I'm happy to talk to people and clients. And as I said, I've met multiple trainers and happy to, you know, spread things out a little bit and, you know, certainly strategically, but John and Tanya are like, you know, my friends and, you know, and someone that I really want to, you know, if I'm writing the story of my life, hey, I want to pick out a horse and win the Derby with John and Tanya. Now I'll do it with anybody, but, you know, that would be the way I would write the story.
And from the horse player side, I mean, how much would you say the parallels? You know, how much of making, you know, decisions on wagers? How does it affect, you know, these kinds of decisions? And is it the same skill set? And I suppose we could even talk about you trading on the stock exchange floor similarly.
Sure. I think it's a whole bunch of things, right? So I think I don't want to talk about myself too much, but like from my perspective, of course, the inventory management and the valuation. So inventory management, understanding what investors might come for at a particular option chain, understanding how to hedge out that option chain with something else, understanding risk return on every trade, understanding quick thinking and the need to, you know, the ability to operate in what's called a fast market, even though you used to get to go wide, right? So gambling, now, if you're gambling on horses and you're trying to look at five races and you're trying to bet on every single race, you're making those rapid fire decisions. You have very limited time. And I don't care how much time someone puts into handicapping. You know, so if I'm trying to draw parallels between pinhooking or bloodstock and handicapping, you're putting way more time into the bloodstock and really making sure, because the time period is longer, the financial commitment's longer, you know, and the payout is not necessarily going to be as high on a return basis, but it's going to be, in my opinion, far less risk than betting every race. Now, of course, I love racing. So if you can limit your gambling and find opportunities or leverage things, you know, you also have the ability to make massive scores. So I love gambling on races, but it's hard to overcome, you know, the takeout if you're betting too much. But, you know, here's another, you know, it's not necessarily answering your question, but so the years that I've spent, you know, not buying horses, but shortlisting, you know, not only to show people my work product, I've used it for gambling. So, for example, last year, I loved Nysos. He was my favorite horse. So, you know, I was in Kentucky at the yearling sales, and I'm like, oh, my God, Nysos has entered. And he's entered against, you know, another horse that worked spectacularly here that sold for $1.3 million. And I'm like, this one is gonna get all the money. Nysos has Kyle Frey up. I'm going to bet a pick six and single the horse. And, like, you know, go to work and look at a million yearlings, and hopefully later I'll check it and I'll watch the replay and I'll be right about Nysos. And I was. You know, and I did something similar where I hammered Kinza to win in her first race with a horse that I bought that's turned out to be just okay. You know, Quincy Ryder, you know, a partner and my, we hit the pick five by singling the horse. So I think that there's so much work that from a gambling perspective, even if you're not buying horses, if someone's a professional gambler, I would have a bloodstock agent giving you notes from these sales, because I think that, you know, all the time I have a horse on my watch that says, remember that horse? You know, didn't really get the vet, or we had questions on the airway, which is why we couldn't buy, but, you know, the horse looks really good. So, you know, those were some of my good scores. One, there was a horse I loved last year named Yellow Card. He ended up ranking his maiden recently at Turfway for Mike McCarthy.
Yep.
Now, in his first race, he was 15-1. So I went crazy betting him win in place, you know, and I lost. He ran into a first-time Asmussen horse that was an expensive yearling, and then I think the half to Slow Down Andy or something. It was someone, or Matoli. It was someone big from Lobo. you know, so the horse ran a great third at 15 to one. I lost. But, you know, I think that the bloods, there's so much that I've learned from being here, because I used to pick up the racing form and be like, these idiots, this horse wants turf. Stage door Johnny turf, you know, and you just every year you get a little bit smarter. So I'm still dumb, or I'm still not that smart, but you learn every year. And but to me, the more, you know, I know so many smart people, really good gamblers, but they've never been down here. So you say, oh, yeah, all the authentics are going to be great. All the and it's just not the case. So you do get some, you know, some sires that are going to stand out and throw more individuals, you know, and others that you may have to be a little pickier on. But it really comes down to the individual, and they can come from anywhere, you know, and obviously there's some consignments that just pick good horses out. So that's why year in and year out, they're going to sell good horses, you know, and they care for them well. So those consignments are all going to do well. But, you know, every year here, there's someone that pops up. I mean, I think, you know, Yellow Card sold from a small consigner. So there's always a little bit of value, you know, to be had. And if you do the right thing, you know, and you do your homework.
Seth Morris with us that you should be following at SM Thoroughbreds on Twitter. And Seth, before I let you go, reflections on Vegas, which I'm sure, you know, you mulled it over and it pops in your head, or you see horses running back from final table and whatnot, with some post-NHC thoughts.
You know, it was such an incredible experience. It is every year, despite the performance. You know, my friend Pete Yan was out there this year, a new friend, Jay Alonzo. I met a guy, Dan Warden, at the sale. Excuse me, at the sale, at the NHC. You know, a couple of my friends, Matt Page and Doug Miller, didn't make it this year, but we're hoping to grab them in the future. And I met a ton of, you know, we were sitting right near the good, you know, Sally Goodall and Brett Wiener, Brett and Sarah Wiener. And it was just, you know, for me to be like losing my, you know, my proverbial whatever and jumping around and going nuts and getting mocked by Todd Schrupp for my lack of attire, you know, even though I had no intention of being on camera that day. You know, it was just an incredible experience. And, you know, obviously you look back at the final table and, you know, I look at it and I say, I did everything right. You know, the place price on the first final table horse, where I used the 15 to one and the 5-2 favorite one, that I thought was the difference that allowed, you know, Mr. Gillum to use the 11 horse in the penultimate race to, you know, get past me with the favorite, you know, but I got great prices throughout it. So you can't look at it, you know, like that. You know, if you say you're going to make the final table, I think the first goal is like trying to get to Sunday, right? And then to get to the final table is incredible. And, you know, of course, I middle moved explosively and, you know, I was, don't get run down. And you did. And it's a big dollar difference. But I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, I took a big shot this year going into Bloodstock full time. So the money certainly helps and helps in with the family situation. I've got two kids that are still going to be going to college. So like I said, I'm excited to have the publicity, to have met so many people. And, you know, even walking around the sale, you know, hey, well, that's that guy that's been signing tickets for 10 years and annoying us pulling out every horse. So, you know, hopefully I'll be signing some more tickets here, but it's good to meet, you know, more people here and, you know, get more information year after year.
Well, and then, of course, the final question, will there be a return to Vegas, to the Sphere, to see Dead & Company?
Oh, there 100% will be. Of course, you know, in my impatience, I bought early tickets, didn't focus on my daughter's 3-day soccer tournament Memorial Day weekend. And then the second set of tickets I decided to buy because my girlfriend and I are both, you know, avid Deadheads, and I have a ton of friends that were planning on, you know, meeting me at some point or another, happened to be the Father's Day weekend. So right now we're still thinking Father's Day weekend, but I don't know if I can catch a red eye back or the first flight back and do kind of a dinner that night and not be too, you know, my kids won't care, but, you know, for my father and my father-in-law, I'd like to be there for them. So we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Well, if you need to do any, you know, swaps, I'll send you Rick Hammerly's number because Hammer will be mad. He's their opening night at least, and he might be able to help you with some flip-flops.
Well, that sounds great. Well, Steve, it was so nice talking to you and meeting you out in Vegas. And, you know, I love the show, and, you know, thank you for having me on.
Not at all. Good luck today, HIP 125, the Nyquist Colt, Thuristock, Nick Sallusto, and the team. And then this is actually the family of Cyberknife, so maybe Al Gold's in on this one, and he's watching. Then on closing day, 1174, so early and late. The Cupid Colt, HIP 1174 on Friday, and then we'll see you at Timonium 2.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Steve.
Seth, good luck. Thank you. Seth Morris, SM Thoroughbreds, if you're not following Seth, a lot of fun. And he was, you know, he was poised, you know, poised for that NHC title, but that's not... It's not easy. Not easy. Let's get to Dave. Dave Hill next. Chauncey Morris is going to join us. I broke up the Morrises. tomorrow, Morris Day will join us. And on Thursday, Morris the Cat. that's, you know, it's quality radio comedy. Can I tell you? Well, and speaking of quality, you know, a Dave Hill visit is they always reek of quality. Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I was busy this morning. Did I send you that text too early?
No, I was up and at him. You know, I have three kids, so I get up early.
That's a good
I have
point.
A dog.
And the dog. Wow, you got, you know, you got the mother of all dogs.
Yeah, I have to go to bed early and wake up early in this house.
Well, I was reading early, and I don't know if you were listening when I mentioned that I confirmed that you were going to join us, but you wrote a piece that... basically, you know, tells your professional story. And it's funny, we've talked so many times and it's always about your writing. I think we've hinted at your union organizing, origins. But you know, this was as much as I've ever, you know, seen you talk about it. And you're a huge advocate for, you know, for union, you know, for unions in general. But this piece has a universal, kind of a universal appeal and outreach, I thought, Dave, that makes it applicable to, you know, racing and pretty much any walk of life.
Well, that's true. I'm glad to hear that. I mean, you know, when I first got asked to write this piece, it was a friend of mine who is editing this series. It's part of a series that they're doing about writers and money. And I said to her, you know, this is, I feel like this happens like every year there's another publication that wants to do, you know, that wants writers to write about this. I feel like it's a perpetual, topic about, you know, the sort of economics of writing and how people are able to make a living or not make a living, as it were, you know. And she said, yeah, it's well-worn territory for sure, but you know, it was her turn to to do something on it. So but it's, I'm also on the board of the National Writers Union, so it's something I think about a lot. I feel, and I spend a lot of time talking to a lot of writers around the country, so I feel like I have a good sense of, you know, sort of a broad survey of the types of writers in America and how they're piecing together a living month to month.
And the website is DIRT, Digital Culture and Entertainment Insights. And I wasn't familiar with it, but we'll certainly visit again. And it's called Writing as Labor, Doing More with Less Together. And it's very revealing. You know, you frequently include, you know, personal, personal effects in your writing. But this one really tells, a lot of your story and your professional life, and more than anything I've read of yours beside this.
Yeah, for me, I mean, writing is like kind of a second act for me. You know, I spent a long time, pretty much all of my 20s and my early 30s, I traveled the country as a union organizer. And so this is sort of a different second act for me in my life. But yeah, a lot of it was sort of spurred on by my father dying. And, you know, he died, my son was born, and a lot of things kind of happened all at the same time that conspired to, you know, I don't know, force me into a very early midlife crisis, I guess. And I ended up, you know, turning to writing. And then I got, as I was saying the piece, like I got really lucky really fast and was able to figure out ways to make a living at this thing that's really hard to make a living at for most people. You know, I did it on the side for quite a while before I was able to figure out how to make money at it.
And what's interesting, I mean, you know, we've kind of crossed paths in essence. I wouldn't call it mid-career as a writer, because I'm looking at the timeline, and actually, you know, you were really just hitting stride in terms of your placements and your assignments, and you know, you were well into the, you know, the start of the vapors. But it's really a relatively, you know what, it's just over 10 years or more.
Yeah, I started writing. I quit my day job in 2015. But prior to that, I was publishing a lot around like 2010, 2011 is when I first started getting bylines. But it's funny, you know, even before that, when I was in those days when I used to travel the country, I used to call your show. So you and I spoke to each other long before we actually ever met.
That's true. And you know, because you'd been referred, you know, as part of, you know, my discovery of Hot Springs when I first started, you know, going to Hot Springs. It's fascinating to me. And you know, the union organizer portion, to me, it was also exceedingly entertaining. I hope you appreciated what I was going to tweet.
Yeah, about Norma Ray, the reference to the movie.
Yes,
Norma Ray.
Yeah. That was the first thing that popped in my head was kvetch, 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 which is the
yeah.
Sally Field's fabulous line to Reuben, to Ron Liebman. It's funny that there's a movie that sort of defines the union organizer. There couldn't be a better, you know, more apt portrayal, no?
I think so, for sure. I mean, at least, I mean, the work has probably changed a lot, but when I was doing it, even in like the early 2000s, and to be fair, I worked for the same union that Norma Ray's about. You know, I was working for the Clothing Workers Union, but my life, you know, living in hotels in these little small towns and meeting, you know, people from all walks of life and kind of having to like become a part of their life and their community the way that the guy in that movie does was pretty, I thought it was pretty realistic. But, you know, Norma Ray is based on a true story, and those are all real people that really, you know, lived. And what's really fascinating about Norma Ray is that the movie came out in, 77, I believe. That election, union election that it's about, happened in 74, and they still hadn't even had a first contract yet when the movie came out. The movie coming out was had a lot to do with the J.P. Stevens company finally caving in and giving into the union, because they had still been fighting even when the movie came out. So the movie wasn't even about ancient history. It was about a story that was currently happening. The woman that Norma Ray was based on was out there still handing out leaflets on the plant gates when there's a major motion picture about her in the theaters, which I'm sure was a surreal experience for her.
This is a topic that, you know, the unions have been sadly marginalized to some degree, but still have just a hugely important role. And there's been plenty of conversation and examples that have been really, you know, top of the fold, as it were, including, you know, Starbucks and some other retail unions, food service workers. You know, a lot of this has to do with, you know, with the hourly wage debate. and discussions to bring this over to racing. It's kind of interesting that you would think there's potential for union organization, backstretch workers, etc. I just was curious about what you feel the modern, the modern landscape, what is out there right now, and the evolution.
Well, I mean, I think that, and I'm happy to not soapbox on your show about this topic that your listeners may not care too much about, but I do think that there is an interesting analog for racing fans to think about here, and that's that, labor today, organized labor is really at its weakest point it's ever been, probably in American history, believe it or not. I mean, it's, it's probably 6 to 7% of the private sector. It's really public sector unions that are propping up a lot of the, union members in America. But cops and firefighters and teachers and that sort of thing, and state workers, those are the bulk of union members in America today. So it's at a nadir. But you mentioned a few stories, examples of where new industries that had never really had any unions at all are starting to organize. And there's this feeling that maybe that there's a generation coming up that they have completely, a different attitude about this and are less afraid, and that the economy is such that there's an opening for, maybe another resurgence of organizing. And I think this is something that racing can think about when people have already read the last rites over you and said, it's dead, it's a thing of the past, it's, it's anachronistic or whatever, we don't need it anymore. And people have certainly said that about our sport too. And I think that, it's not, I think it's important to remember that these things are cyclical, and that they're, every generation that comes along, there's a new opportunity for people to sort of discover these things all on their own and embrace them, and maybe for completely different reasons than the last generation did, So I think that that's one of the things that this sport can think about, is how everything that's old can be new again.
How much of the loss of union clout traces back to PATCO and the busting up of the air traffic controllers?
Yeah, I think that had a lot. That certainly started that empowered employers to fight them, fight unions. But what really happened in America is that our economy shifted very dramatically in the 90s with NAFTA, and we lost our manufacturing base pretty quickly. I mean, it happened really, really fast. And so the labor movement wasn't prepared for that, and they weren't able to figure out how to organize the new economy that grew up in its place. And so here we are, 30 years later, and they're just now figuring out how to do that. It's not for, workers in those industries are just now figuring out how to organize. So, the American economy looks a lot different today than it did in 1980. The places that we work, I mean, we can see it, we can see it in the cities that we live in, the cities in America that were like the big cities in America in the 80s aren't big cities anymore. They're ghost towns, and different cities have grown. So I think that's what hurt labor more than anything.
The other part, the second half of Dave Hill's piece at Dirt is about the various assignments that you've unearthed, as well as the success of the Vapors and the revenue that gave you confidence to buy a house and a car that you seem to regret. what it immediately made me think of, though, from the racing standpoint, and not just racing media, although racing media comes to mind, the piecemeal work that's involved, and the way you describe, gathering these jobs, Dave, and the variety of paychecks essentially that you earn over the course of a calendar year, it reminds me of how there's a lot of horse racing media landscape that is very similar, and I don't think Nick Tamaro will mind me using him as an example, but here he is calling races at Sam Houston and making the morning line, at Keeneland and elsewhere, doing the handicapping work on several circuits for Twin Spires, etc. That immediately came to mind for me. The similarities. And then I thought about it, and it extends, to virtually every aspect of revenue generation on the racetrack. I mean, trainers have a variety of clients. The farrier draws from handfuls of barns, etc. Piecework almost.
Yeah, I mean, I see, in media, one of the things I say in the piece is that, there's different types of writers. There's freelance writers, and there's sort of folks who have staff writer positions somewhere where they write for a living, but they have they write for one place and it's their job. They get a paycheck, etc. And then being a freelancer is sort of the purest form of being a writer. You write about whatever you're interested in, you sell it to whoever wants to publish it, but that's a very precarious way to earn a living. But more and more people in America are earning their living that way, precariously, through gig work and piecemeal, piecework like you're describing, people that are driving for Uber, delivering food for DoorDash and Instacart. That kind of work is on the rise, and plenty of people are doing it maybe as a second job, maybe as their full-time job. And, you get paid as an independent contractor, per gig or whatever. And I think an increasing number of Americans are earning their living that way. Especially true in media, among people that work in media. And media publications can't figure out how to make money. I mean, we see every week there's another one that's closing their doors. People can't figure out how to make money. Everybody wants to read everything for free, and advertisers are, wanting to pay less and less. So it's bleak out there in the landscape of media, unfortunately. I hope that, that's a cyclical thing, too, and that'll come back around. But right now is a pretty rough time.
What are your suggestions, to those that are trying to break into whatever, in whatever capacity that they're hoping?
Well, one of the things I say in the piece is that this is true today, and it was true in 1980 too. When I talk about this big study that Columbia University did, but a lot of people that are writers. They either have another source of income, another job on the side, or they have a spouse that they can depend on for things like insurance and bills. That's been true for me, and that's allowed me to have some freedom that I otherwise wouldn't have to be able to write. But I think one thing that every writer learns is that if you want to make money, you want to make a good living as a writer, you got to go to Hollywood because that's where all the money is. And I think this is an important point, and it's one that maybe ties a bow around this whole conversation. The entertainment industry in Hollywood, television and film, there is so much money to be made out there. And I even talk in the piece about how I wrote my book. I was very excited to get a six-figure book deal. I thought I'd really arrived, but then I made even more money when I optioned the book for TV. And that blew my mind that the amount of money they were going to pay me just to have an option on the rights, not even to buy the rights, was more than what I made for writing the book. Because in Hollywood, that was just a drop in the bucket when in the sort of on the level of figures that they think about when they're budgeting for projects, So it's on such a different scale. There's also tons of competition for those jobs and for that work, but it pays really, really well. And I think this is important because the entertainment industry is really America's last great export. It's the last thing that we export to the world. It's a very profitable industry where we make movies and TV shows that people all over the world watch. We make music that people listen to all over the world. And this is an industry that is wall-to-wall unionized from craft services to the A-list actors. Everybody that works on a TV show for a big streamer or a network or for on a movie for a big studio, it's all these productions are completely done union. They have very strong contracts. They've had, they've had good labor standards in the entertainment industry forever. And, that's really been to the benefit of the creatives that work in those fields, and it has been to the detriment of creatives that work in every other field in the American sort of creative industrial complex. So for people like me who want to write books and write for magazines, you know, our standards have consistently just gotten worse and worse and worse as our industries have struggled. When they struggle to figure out how to make money, they say, well, we'll just pay people less, and that's how we'll make more money. That hasn't happened in Hollywood. So my advice to people who want to write for a living and make good money is go to LA and, you know, find an agent, because that's where the money's at.
Apply it to our, you know, to our business, to racing. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, one of your great skills, as a writer, some pieces it's intentional, others it's just, conveyed organically, you know, but there's a universality to what you write about, and this is applicable to anybody that's trying to break into any arena. And you talk about essentially, you rifled through every editor, every assignment desk, you peppered and papered everybody in search of work.
When my wife quit her job, she became a consultant. I needed to find a job to get some health insurance for us, and that's when I used to pride myself. I didn't want to have a job. I wanted to be a freelancer. There's a lot of freedom associated with being a freelancer. Free is right there in the name. And I always thought free meant freedom. I found out free meant how much you're getting paid, but I didn't realize that at the time. I didn't want to have to get a job, but I decided I would do it when she quit her job, and then nobody would hire me. A lot of places that loved my work and were happy to have me write for them did not want to put me on staff. So I'm glad, in the retrospect, I'm glad that nobody did, because it was sort of a moment where I was really I felt like it was kind of a crisis moment, but we were able to figure a way out of it. And now I'm glad that I'm still freelance. But at the time, it was surprising to me how hard it was, because I was willing to take a job anywhere. I mean, I interviewed for, corporate copywriting jobs and couldn't get those. I couldn't get, hired by publications that I've bylined at a lot. So it's tough out there. I think that it's more likely that people will get laid off. More and more people are being laid off, which means more and more really capable, talented writers are looking for jobs. And I just think that's just, part of that business right now. I figured it out, and I'm still able to freelance, and I'm doing all right. I mean, I'm not, the piece wasn't about, somebody please hire me. It was about that moment where I needed to get hired and how I was really shocked at how tough it was, because it was the first time in a decade that I really tried to do that.
Well, and I, I occasionally backtrack to my involvement in the show. I had made a decision as well at a certain point when I came back to the U.S. And I was lucky that I had, the food service, consultancy and brokerage business as a certain income stream. But I wanted to get into racing media, and I wrote some freelance pieces for Blood Horse. Steve Askin helped me. I had started a website, which is about as low cost a way to self-publish at the time as there is, and I guess still is. You see what's going on at Substack, and you made some references to, the way people have generated income, real sizable income streams for themselves that way. But, I this gig fell into my lap in 2005. Gus Alonso was doing the handicapping, and he had to move to Chicago, and he reached out to me and said, I recommended you, to JJ and John Parada and Sam. And the next thing I knew, I've got a lifelong dream, and I didn't, there was no revenue, there was no pay for several years. So there's a certain amount of sacrifice, and I guess you have to have a certain safety net in place, or a strategy. it's worth pursuing, and at least you know, at least there's options out there, Dave, I think, for people that, you know, that want to try.
Yeah, and I think, you know, horse racing is like a, you know, the horse racing media universe is a bit of a you know, it's a bit of a kind of a bubble, you know, it's a little bit of a closed system, and that's good, I think, in some ways, because it means that people that really love this sport are going to have an easier time getting access and finding other people who love it, who will encourage their love of this sport. It's, you know, I started out writing about horse racing, and it was because I loved racing, but it was also because the publications that I first started writing for, I realized that there were a lot of people that wanted to write about basketball, but there weren't a lot of people asking to write about the Kentucky Derby or, you know, or about the Belmont. And so it was easier for me to get those assignments, but I was happy to, because I loved it, you know? And, I would say that folks who love racing and they want to write about it, you know, you should think about pitching those stories, because, this is a sport where people are so generous and kind with their time. They're unlike other sports where people are very closed and guarded and don't want to want to talk to journalists. In racing, people love talking about their sport, almost like evangelizing it. And I found that made it my job a lot easier when I would write about racing. I think it's a great sport to cover, and I think for especially people starting out or new journalists that are wanting to get involved in sports writing, you know, write about horse racing, because it's because people will make your life and your job a lot easier. And I certainly found that all across the sport, that, you know, just wonderful people and a wonderful, you know, wonderful community around the sport that, that helped me a lot.
Well, and one of the unique things about racing as a tableau is you've got owners, you've got breeders, you've got handicapping, and wagering, you've got, the sales, the pedigree, there is the personalities, the trainers, the jockeys, the history. There is maybe more specific avenues of entree to get involved in racing, I think, than almost anywhere. I don't, you know, that's not true of any team sport.
It's not. And it's not anything any of the people writing about the sports want to write about. You know, I think that I actually think one of the reasons that so many great pieces of sports journalism throughout history have been about horse racing is because the horse racing fan is a better reader. I mean, I'm not saying this just to gas up your audience, but I do think that, like, you know, people that want to read about, I mean, I learned this when I was writing about the NFL for the New York Times, like, people that want to read about football, they just want to read about the scores, the stats, you know what I mean? Like, that I think that horse racing fans are more, they're just a different breed of sports fan, in the sense that they are more open to reading the kinds of stories that are a bit more narrative type journalism, or more lyrical and more poetic. You know, I think that that's why we see so many great pieces throughout history that have been about this sport. It's not necessarily because, I don't know, it's something about the sport, but it's also about the fans of horse racing and about the types of people that end up wanting to write about it too. I think of horse racing as quite magical, you know, and as a sporting event. And, so I just think that because of that, that magic that exists around sport, around horse racing, the people that are writing about it and the people that are reading about it all have a different type of experience, almost a more literary experience in reading and writing about it than you'd see in other sports in America.
Well, and it also, of course, has, you know, a certain regal continence and a majesty that also is equally balanced by a seemly underbelly.
Yeah. One could also say that, you know, the horses can't speak for themselves, so they need a rider to to imagine their their thoughts and motivations, whereas other athletes do get to speak for themselves, sometimes to their detriment.
Exactly. A horse may underperform on the racetrack, but they won't disappoint you by
opening their mouths and saying something buffoonish. You know, instead, riders get to imagine the inner workings of the horse's mind, and maybe that's why some of the writing is much better.
Dave Hill, we do have a second part of this visit to talk about, but I invite anybody that has got my timeline from this morning, and I really urge you to visit this piece that Dave penned for dirt.com, and I have it. Let's see, it went out 6 hours ago. Don't miss this Dave Hill morsel. And it's actually the address is unusual, right? Dirt.
I think it's XYZ. Yeah, .xyz.
FYI.
FYI. Okay.
There it is. Dirt FYI. All right. And writing as labor. And I think you'll find it as engaging as I did. Dave, you sent out, utilizing your postcard vehicle to your subscribers, information about the release today of Stephen Panis's heartbreaking story of his son, Walk On, and how'd you get involved in Steve's project?
Well, he had shared it with me a while back when I think he had first finished it, and I mentioned in my email this morning about how tough it was to read. Even then, today's the pub date for the book, and somebody who's written a book. I mean, ordinarily, the pub date for your first book is a big day in your life, and it's filled with excitement, and it's a fun day. But this is a little bit more complicated because of the subject matter of the book. But it's a wonderfully written book, and it's something that I think will actually bring, a lot of it'll help a lot of people. And I went into reading the book with some trepidation as a parent, but then found that I couldn't put it down. And I think other people have the same experience. So I wanted to send it out. I wanted to do that for Steve because I liked the book, but also, when I was talking before about writing about horse racing and all the people that, and how helpful people were, I mean, he's definitely one of those people, that I met in this industry that was incredibly helpful, always willing to be helpful. And is just, he's a gem of a person. And I'm glad that he wrote this book, and I know that people that need it will find it, and it'll help them if they do. So I want to do everything I can to help promote it.
Well, and of course, his son, Jake, killed in a car accident, and just agonizing. Everybody that knows Stephen Panis, every time he's tried to raise awareness and in some cases money for causes that and in fact a cause that has been crafted out of Jake's passing, the industry responds, but this is different. And Sid Fernando last Wednesday, in fact, made a reference, as being part of a fraternity that no one wants to be a part of,
and
losing a child. And there's been a disproportionate. It maybe it's just anecdotal or just because we're so insular as an industry. But Mark Reed and the Kasners and Sid, and there's been too many, and even of course the Motts, the young Riley Mott and his wife. I mean, there's been more than anybody could have ever would ever want. So I wanted you to talk about Walk On here because, and I don't know if Stephen wants to come, and I'll make the offer, but I thought it was an opportunity, you know, to make people aware.
Yeah, and, you know, he's somebody who, I mean, I wrote for ABR for a long time, and you know, he was somebody who ostensibly edited stuff that I had written. He's a hell of a writer in his own right. And I mean, that book, you know, it's really, it's so well written that I think it helps. I mean, he's so honest and vulnerable and real in it, but it's such a tough topic, but he makes it, his writing, I think, makes it something where I felt at the end of the book kind of pleased that I had read it and felt hopeful and optimistic. And that's not what you'd expect to feel like after reading a book that's about grief and about such a terrible thing happening. So props to Stephen Panis for, you know, having taken such a tough topic and dealt with it so adeptly. And yeah, the guy's a good writer. He's a behind the scenes guy, but I think he should, you know, he should think about writing more because I really enjoyed reading it.
Not, you know, don't want him taking work away from you though.
That's right.
Dave Hill, everybody, as always, I had this opening because Andy Serling was going to be unavailable today, and I couldn't think of a better opportunity for a eclectic conversation. How'd you make out in the NCAAs?
Oh, I did good. My Calcutta, I did all right because I bought Connecticut. I bought them for quite a bit of money, but they paid off big time. So they were world beaters.
Well, you and Rich Ang got them at 18-1 in an advance bet early in December.
Yeah, the Calcutta I was in, I had some teams that didn't pan out for me as well as I needed them to, but then I had the winner. And that's the thing about Calcutta is there's two ways you can really make money. You can either accurately pick the upsets or you can, you know, accurately have the championship winner. So I ended up with that. And last year, I think I had a lot more of the upsets come in for me. But yeah, now it's over and the NBA playoffs are about to start and I'm trying to shift my, my thing. And then we're about to enter Triple Crown season, which is another, you know, another fun thing to save my money to bet on. I've also been playing the Exactathons every weekend and doing pretty good with those too in Express Business.
Nice job. I will circle back to you Derby week and get Derby opinion.
Oh, for sure. I've always got that ready, locked and ready. You know, I would say the Kentucky Derby is. I get text messages from so many people that I don't talk to all year long, and then suddenly they text me wanting to know who my Derby horse is. I'm sure plenty of your listeners have the same experience.
No doubt, no doubt about it. You know, some years you put them in the right direction, and some years, you know, you just miss. It's a point of pride. It's one of those funny, selections
they don't want to hear about my they don't want to hear about my $120 try that I'm gonna bet. They want one horse.
Exactly.
They just want to know one horse, one name. That's all they want. So I have to be ready for that.
Well, Dave Hill is always ready for my call for whatever topic, and David, as always, thank you.
All right, Steve, thanks.
Dave Hill, folks, and just smart and funny. The two best attributes in entertainment. Smart and funny. You can't, right? You can't beat it. That's something I learned from Tony Kornheiser years ago, from the years of listening to Tony on his show, around his radio show. We're going to round out. It's funny that Derby comes up as a closing point, because as it happens, we're going to talk Derby. We're going to talk the Derby Trainers Dinner. The other Morris, Chauncey Morris, is going to join us here momentarily, and we'll advertise. I'm unabashedly will advertise and hawk the trainer's dinner. Chauncey, good morning.
Hey, Steve, how are you? Good morning.
Excellent here, and I appreciate the opportunity. I referenced this the other day when I had a window, and it really has become, I mean, in the 20-plus years that I've been, you know, covering Derby professionally, I mean, the trainer's dinner has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
Except for COVID, that's definitely true.
Oh, good. There you go. Good point. What's intriguing is the venue and utilizing, you know, that gorgeous room, the first turn. I think that this has got to enhance the whole undertaking.
We're certainly hopeful of that. Churchill Downs has been very gracious to allow us to use the first turn club. If you're spending $74 million on a building, it better be spectacular. Then moreover, I think partially because we asked and partially because it's Derby week, they also allowed us to use our own caterer, which is Wiltshire Pantry, which if you've been to the last two iterations of the Derby Trainers Dinner at the Speed Museum, that's who the caterer was.
Nice. Let's give everybody the specifics for starters. And of course, this is
sure.
This is a KTA production. Has that always been the case? Or talk about, actually, before we give that all out, talk about the evolution of the event.
Yeah, it's a good question. So from memory going back over 50 years, we've been the stewards of the event, an event that has been in some time or another in place for literally decades, that as long as everyone is remembered in modern history, there's always been a Derby Trainers Dinner that happens on Tuesday of Derby Week. This year, it's going to be, as always, Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. The cocktail time will start at 5 p.m. That's significant because Churchill Downs will be racing that day. Their last race is at 4:55 p.m. The idea is folks will start wandering over from the races. Long cocktail hour. Dinner will start at 6:30. And then, of course, the program where inviting all the trainers that are in attendance to come up to the stage, speak with Andrew Brown and Darren Zokoli, and talk about their horses and talk about their connections and the stories that sometimes aren't always reported. And if you've been in attendance or watching online, which is increasingly popular, you'll notice that there's always some hilarious moment that'll happen in the course of the night. It'll be from coach saying to the audience, oh, I don't have a Derby horse, and then finally getting in on a pre-recorded message to last year, very entertaining, Hidetaka Odanashi bringing the house down as far as I think a combination of cheer and jet lag. But there's always something copy for the next morning and very entertaining, which we try to set out. And really, from what your previous guest was talking about, Dave, what makes racing, especially the Derby, so compelling are the stories. Well, these are the stories of those people that make the magic in our game. The trainers that are lucky enough to be successful and distinguish themselves to have a horse for their connections in the Derby.
Well, the Tuesday of Derby week. And of course,
yes,
I'll use the opportunity to mention that, you know, Monday we've got the Second Stride affair as well.
Yep.
And this is correct. This is the kind of week that it is. I mean, there is literally, right up until Barnstable Brown, there is something, on a daily basis. And for those that'll be coming to the Ville for the first time, you might find it a little overwhelming, to be honest. the Derby Festival, which actually starts essentially 17 days out or so. Things like Thunder over Louisville, which is two Saturdays out, with a lot of fun. One of the biggest fireworks displays in the world, not even just in the U.S. The riverboat race, the balloon, the hot air balloon rally, balloon glow. There is just so much excitement and festivity. Chuck Wagon downtown, and it is so much more. I mean, the way in which the town celebrates Derby is, to me is as exciting and enjoyable as Derby itself. And the trainer's dinner really is one of those events that brings kind of things into focus. It's funny because a lot of times it would be the night that the draw would have occurred, and the draw is going to occur now Saturday, so we'll have the field intact essentially.
Correct.
There won't be as much of that kind of hullabaloo. We'll have known really for 3 days how the field shaped up.
Yeah, that's right. And what you're saying about what Louisville does, kind of put its best foot forward for 150 years for the Kentucky Derby. It's a culmination, if you are a Kentuckian, of what we happen to do better than I think anyone in the world is race horses. In this state, we've had just mind-blowing success over the past 5 years on our year-round racing circuit, on the investments that have gone on at all of our tracks now, on the growth of the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Everything is just hitting on all cylinders, and we'd love to be able to put together an event that fits all this success, frankly, on top of it being the 150th Kentucky Derby.
One thing we haven't done yet. Let's tell everybody where they can buy tickets. Tickets are $225 each. Tables of 8 or 10 are also available. If you've got a big group that is coming for Derby Week, or you want to put a table together, what's the capacity in that room?
So the capacity of the room is probably 1,500. We're going to use 600. That's important because if you remember the Derby Trainers Dinner before COVID, that we would use the ballroom in the Hyatt, it was always more than 600 people. I think we got as high as 690. COVID came, disrupted that. We had to have the online version of the Trainers Dinner and then an invitation-only version at Hermitage Farm when we were still under COVID restrictions, and then started to grow out and looking for some premium spaces on the speed. An answer for where do you buy tickets? If you go to our website, KentuckyBred.org, you can buy the tickets online there. I would tell every single horseman also, you can look on your overnights or find your condition books and call Jenny McGahee in my office and also arrange for your tickets there. If you are one of the connections, we would have already been in contact, or we'll be in short order in contact with you to be able to look after anything and accommodate your group.
Outstanding. KentuckyBred.org. And, we should, Chauncey, while I've got you, we should also celebrate, in addition to, inviting people to attend. I mean, this is not that's the point of this conversation. This is not a closed event or a media event. It's for stakeholders, fans, horse players, everybody in town. And it is crazy fun. Chauncey is downplaying the frivolity and the humor that comes with it. It's there's a lot of jokes and the trainers the trainers, they come armed with material. I mean, nobody more so than Lucas, but that's expected.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, there are multiple stories that everybody has. It's just one or two that might make it past and crack the veil the next morning that everybody's sharing, you know, video of or what have you. But yes, it is open to all comers. It is just one part of what makes that week so special here in Kentucky. And is, as we said before, talking about or hearing firsthand from the folks that put on the show.
Well, and as part of this, and one thing that I'll stress, I've mentioned it, you know, several times, but not actually lately. And this is a perfect time for it as the fields begin to come together, not just for Derby and Oaks, but for the whole week and all the stakes action. At the KentuckyBred.org website is the outstanding treasury of workout videos that has been established, and it has become a huge resource. And if you are not utilizing it, I mean, you've heard Marcus Hirsch make reference to it, John Nichols when he's on with us as well. It is a absolutely invaluable resource. So take advantage, KentuckyBred.org, not just to buy tickets for the trainer dinner on Tuesday, April 30th, but you can put in searches and you can find the most recent workouts of the stake horses, and not just stake horses, every division. This has been an absolute home run, Chauncey.
I appreciate you saying that. I have to give a hat tip definitely to two individuals, Bruno DiJulio and Gary Palmisano. Gary Camp coming at it from a horse player's perspective, working with the racetracks to use their Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Funds, which if the advisory committee approves that they can use some of their KTDF allotment for marketing. This was one way that we knew that providing horse players more information would be helpful to the live wagering product. And if you look at our metrics on this, you can check it. Look after Bruno's Twitter feed who shares it. They're off the charts. It's really unbelievable, and it's been a very worthwhile investment. We bought some of the equipment for Bruno, I think, in order to ensure that we get full coverage for every horse, hopefully in the circuit. That's the goal. We might have to do more of that, and that's a good problem to have, you know. I appreciate y'all. I would also say it's not the only thing you can do on our website, that if you have a Kentucky bred horse and you want to check the whether it's KTDF eligible and whether it has been registered in the program, you can also register your horse there. Don't leave money on the table. You know, in the program last year, we offered $54.9 million in Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Funds, and we paid out $48.2 million. Now, some of that, sometimes, unfortunately, are horses that they're not registered. And so, but then other times, of course, it's Florida breds or Irish breds or other horses. But Kentucky is, we have unrestricted racing here, so we want the best horse to win. But if it is a KTDF eligible horse, we certainly want you to win all the money that you're owed.
Well, and I'll do it tomorrow, but of course the KTA and the KTOB the other day had the Broodmare of the Year, which is the biggest award of its kind, and Dance Card, the Dam of Cody's Wish, and the rest of the ceremony. I'll get to that tomorrow, and as well as I've got to do the Zidane court story. And by the end of the week, it looks like the court will have an answer on whether they will grant or refuse a temporary injunction. Chauncey, this was tremendous. I appreciate the chance to catch up and direct people to KentuckyBred.org and to attend the dinner. We'll provide a couple more reminders as we get closer.
We appreciate it, and thank you for everything that you do for our sport.
Not at all. Chauncey Morris, everybody, and the KTA, and the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund as well, and they very quietly do a lot of good work. This is a lot of fun if you've never been, all right? KentuckyBred.org. This was a head-spinning 3 hours. Thanks to Lisa Lazarus and the HISA visit to start the morning. Phil Schoenthal joined us to kind of provide some perspective to his experience and a satisfying conclusion. Seth Morris, who I would say within an hour or so is going to sell that hip today, and good luck to him and partners. Hip 125, watch for that. Dave Hill, who's just always fabulous. He may be guest of the year, every year. Dave Hill, so many interesting conversations. And Chauncey just now with the trainer's dinner and more. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Kind of a quiet Tuesday. And Indy back with day two of their meet. We'll get into some handicapping and more tomorrow. Keeneland gets going again. So lots to look at, plus Indy again. We'll do some Indy tomorrow. Replay 6 to 9 here on Sirius XM. Archive podcast to come as well. Post-production. And I'll talk to you in the morning. Thanks.
Horsemen, nominate now for Penn National's biggest day of the season, the $400,000 Grade 3 Penn Mile. In the $150,000 Penn Oaks will both be run Friday, May 31st, on a card that also includes two Pennsylvania bred stakes, each with a $100,000 purse. Call the racing office at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse, 800-233-8238. That's 800-233-8238. Nominations close May 15th.
Racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
An app created specifically for horse racing. Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action in thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Whether you're new to the racing game or just looking to enhance your operation, Hermitage Farm and Goshen can help you. We are conveniently located between Churchill Downs and Keeneland Racecourse and near world-renowned equine hospitals. With spacious paddocks, expert staff, and qualified veterinarians, we offer full-service boarding, breeding, and sales preparation, as well as post-operative care and layup services. Visit us in person or online at hermitagefarm.com.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Scholarships are available. Visit rtip.arizona.edu.